Support comes from the St. Louis Chamber Chorus. Season 68 concludes at John Burroughs at 3 p.m. on May 26th with the United Nations commissioned Voices of Today by composer Benjamin Britten, featuring youth and adult singers. Tickets at chamberchorus.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Be it creamed, buttered on the cob, or ground into meal for bread or tortillas, the culinary possibilities for the small but mighty corn kernel are boundless. There's even a much maligned candy made to look like them. But the powerhouse crop has applications far beyond gastronomy, and a new Missouri Botanical Garden exhibition called Kernels of Culture, Maize Around the World, is showcasing just how versatile and important corn has been for thousands of years. Neshka Pfeffer is curator at MoBot. She joins us now to talk about this collaborative, multifaceted look at maize. Neshka, welcome back to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, first of all, the difference between corn and maize. What is the difference, and what difference does it make?
For Americans, probably not very much, but maize is the original word for what we Americans call corn or yellow corn, and the scientific name is Zea, maize. But when English colonists came and realized what a powerhouse crop this particular grain was, they had a tendency to call everything corn. So if it was barley corn, wheat corn, everything was a corn if it came into little bits.
Okay.
So they called this Indian corn, in fact. And so eventually, in order to kind of be very focused on the fact that this is the botanical plant, Zea maize. We've tried to call it maize throughout much of the show, although we will say corn cobs and so forth. But that's the main, it's kind of a, it's a naming situation.
Mm-hmm. So you told our producer, Roche Hemmings, you know, that corn looks very different depending on where it's growing. And having eaten, there's a tricolor, very glutinous corn that Koreans like to eat. I can attest to the differences. How is it that we got to the corn that we are familiar with here in the U.S.?
That's a good question. So corn started as a wild grass. Pretty much accepted kind of origin story of corn is that it was teosinte, which still exists today, and there are several subspecies of Zea, which are all different teosinte species. But those kernels are not easily edible. They're sort of small and brown and triangular. And over the course of thousands of years, these ancient indigenous hands in Central and South America realized all these different traits that they wanted, and they hybridized and crossbred different teosintes, and it eventually very slowly got to the point where it wasn't anymore this little casing that had these triangular kernels, but it was this tiny little cob that had little yellow kernels.
Mm-hmm.
And then as it spread over the course of thousands of years through South America and then into North America, the colors really are a question of genetics, but they also relate to different kinds of environmental factors as well. So if corn has a very high presence of anthocyanin, it tends to be more colorful. So purple, reds, blues, and blacks. And if it's not present, it tends to be more yellow or white.
And they are raised for very different purposes too, right?
That's right.
So who or what inspired a whole exhibition that is devoted to maize?
Full disclosure, the garden president, Dr. Peter Weiss Jackson, is a big fan of different types of crop subjects. I've already curated an exhibition on the potato several years ago. That was very much his passion project. But corn actually has a very specific relationship to the garden because we happen to have a very historic collection of maize cobs and specimens that were collected in the first half of the 20th century by two key gentlemen, Hugh Cutler and Edgar Anderson. Edgar Anderson was one of the presidents of the garden when the garden still kind of focused on agricultural research. Mm-hmm. It sort of pivoted after that to focus more on conservation and tropical climates and endangered plants. So while we still have a lot of these records in our herbarium collection, we're not necessarily focused on that at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So this collection is a bit of a legacy collection, and it has, because corn is such a ubiquitous crop, it's like number 3 cereal crop in the world.
Right.
And it's used so as you mentioned, so creatively. I mean, about a third of the world's corn crop or maize crop is used for food, you know, directly to be eaten some way. A third is used for animal feed because it's very nutritious, and the last third is used for biofuel applications. Mm-hmm. And so when if you have 10% ethanol at your gas station, that's most likely made from corn product.
Right. And was part of the reason to do this exhibition here because of where we are in the country?
We figured it would do well since we're in the Midwest, and the Midwestern Corn Belt was a very important development in industrialized agriculture mm-hmm. through the 19th and 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that stands out about this exhibition is the way that it is a collaborative effort and also multidisciplinary in nature. Neshka, which of those two came first? Was it the partners or sort of that multidisciplinary framework?
A great question. I would say the multidisciplinary framework first. That is very much how I curate exhibitions at the Sachs Museum at the Garden. Obviously, we are leaders in botany, which is wonderful, but sometimes the science isn't immediately accessible to the general public. And so using the disciplines of art and cultural history enables us to really open up the meaning and the science to the general public. And so mm-hmm. I sort of went into that, but the question was, since we weren't leaders in corn science at the moment, who do I find who would be interested in sharing not only their contemporary scientific research, but also who would be artists who would want to help interpret these, you know, very interesting elements about this plant for our public?
And who was it that you found to be partners?
Oh, great. Great question. So one key partner is Dr. Katie Murphy, who's at the Danforth Plant Science Center here, and one of the lab assistants named Clara LeBeau, who both of them work on different corn research projects. And Dr. Murphy is actually involved. She's the head of the phenotyping lab, so the photography lab. And they work mm-hmm. with the one corn lab, the top lab, to photograph kind of what happens above ground, but also there's x-ray imaging of what happens below ground with corn. And so this is the kind of contemporary corn science that's happening right here in St. Louis. And another key scientist is Dr. Sherry Flint Garcia, who is at the USDA Ag Research Center at the University of Missouri at Columbia mm-hmm. and runs the maize farm there. And so she's a corn geneticist as well, and she is growing like hundreds of varieties of different types of maize that were all developed to be acclimated to different altitudes and different latitudes, different amounts of sunlight, and also to sort of trial newer or like reintroduced maize varieties for food products or drink products. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of maize varieties that are this actually called Bloody Butcher, deep, deep red.
Oh.
It's actually very good for whiskey, amongst other things, including popcorn and other food
applications.
Oh,
okay. Now, these partners, was there anything that they told you that shows up in a very concrete way in the exhibit?
Yes, well, that's actually one of the challenges I give them when we talk about how do I incorporate their research, because not everybody will be reading a scientific paper when they come to the exhibition, right? So how do we make this not just an illustration, but kind of give people the sense of what these things are? And so the Danforth display actually features literally lots of images of all of these different corn plants that grow on this wonderful little conveyor belt mm-hmm. over the course of a few weeks in this lab. So you actually see these images, and then you actually see all the bits and parts of that particular phenotyping lab, the physical carriage that the plant goes in, as well as the camera and the color card. And there's even a handful of videos that they filmed for us that are accessible via QR codes for the public.
So it's multimedia. And was there something that these experts you consulted with, is there anything they told you that you found particularly surprising or interesting as someone who's not coming from sort of the scientific side of things?
Corn has been, it has a very large presence in the agricultural research community, and they really sort of clued me in on how genetically interesting and diverse a maize is. And also, like, one of the key DNA studies that sort of led to mapping the maize genome was done by a woman named Barbara McClintock. There's a lot of women scientists doing this work, too, which is also really interesting. And there's a maize agricultural conference that will happen in different parts of the country, but it happened in St. Louis last year. Oh. So there were all these maize scientists who came and even looked at some of the historic collections. So getting understanding the incredible breadth of people who are studying and interested in this plant, not purely for food applications, but for also understanding how plants work in general, was really eye-opening for me.
Yeah. We're speaking with Neshka Pfeiffer, who is a curator at the Missouri Botanical Garden. We're talking about a new exhibition that is opening very soon here. It is called Kernels of Culture, Maize Around the World. Note, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to maize. Was it a challenge to condense the history and importance of maize into, you know, a single exhibition that covered, you know, all the bases, and also at the same time make it engaging for viewers?
Yes, this was probably, out of all of the exhibitions so far that I've curated here at the Garden, probably one of the most difficult to wrap my mind around in terms of all of the layers of complexity and all of the global impacts of maize. So, you know, there's definitely going to be things that I wasn't going to be able to include because of limitations of space and also limitations of access to certain information. So it was a question of what can I touch upon that will be a, you know, cohesive about amount of information with some interesting things for people to kind of visually absorb, but also hopefully kind of whet their appetite so that if they're really intrigued about this particular aspect of maize and corn, what would they want to go and pursue?
So the disciplines that are represented, one of those is history, obviously, and there's a history of maize that has left certain groups of people out of the story. Neshka, how is that being addressed this time?
A great question. So one of the things I kind of actively stayed away from was sort of looking at the overall industrial history of maize and corn and the Corn Belt specifically, because I felt like there are a lot of history books out there that can really address that. People have access to that. Some of the interns who helped me do research on this particularly, we were kind of really hoping to kind of reconnect the indigeneity of maize to the story. Because in fact, a lot of indigenous hands sort of got removed from the story once it became this, you know, Midwestern crop. It was very much looked at as in the hands of white farmers and not necessarily indigenous farmers. And so there's also a quite large movement that stems out of the American Indian movement towards tribal sovereignty and food sovereignty and rematriation. And a lot of this is in line with things like crop diversity and biodiversity of plants. Like, when you get to a point where the genetics are kind of monolithic, it opens you up to potentially disastrous situations if you lose particularly very important crop plants or other types of plants. So making corn diverse again, which is also some of the work that Sherry Flint Garcia is looking at in her agricultural work, is kind of how can we make this plant so resilient, because it is so useful and it is so nutritious, and it now spans the globe. It's not just a regional local plant. So I highlighted the work. I reached out to a handful of people and highlighted the work of three Black and Indigenous farmers, one of whom here in St. Louis, one in Canada, and one in the Southwest in New Mexico, to sort of talk about the work that they do with maize.
Are there ways for people to interact with that aspect, what you've just explained, beyond, you know, reading or like looking at things? Are there things to touch or perhaps to listen to?
Unfortunately, in terms of those farmers' perspectives, no, but there is material and information on how you can find the work that they do. So it's a little bit more of a kind of that whetting the appetite, hoping people follow that thread. But one of the artists who is in the exhibition, who was quite intrigued by Barbara McClintock's work and had talked to Dr. Murphy at the Danforth, Megan Singleton, she actually will have a couple of things for people to touch. And it is, in fact, corn based paper fiber that she's interpreting, kind of this genetic colorful diversity that corn has. And so some of that, but in terms of like, that's exactly what you'll be able to engage with when you're on site. But I think for a lot of it, hopefully, I'm hoping people will be interested in learning more about all of these movements and also paying attention to the different things that the garden promotes and in classes and so forth, talking about the, you know, how important it is to focus on different kinds of crops.
And you mentioned art. Why art?
To me, I feel that artists can incorporate and interpret any subject. It doesn't have to be purely science, in ways that really tie us to the innately human. You know, they understand how people experience something, so they keep in mind not only the content, you know, intellectual content of what they're sharing in their work, but the time and space in which someone will experience it. And if they have an opportunity to touch it, even better, but understanding that this will hit people, in, impact people, and hopefully, you know, pique their curiosity to learn more is a very sort of psychological element. And I think that's really important for people to experience.
I think one of the things that is interesting is how everyday objects that are useful can also be examples of art because they're created by people. You know, the words technology and processing these days, I think most immediately call to mind, you know, complicated machinery. But are there perhaps implements in this exhibition that point to how long humans have been working and or working with maize to produce, you know, any number of products?
Yes, we actually have some quite ancient objects. Much thanks to the St. Louis Science Center for lending a wonderful collection of stone and stone tools from the Cahokia era and region, so before European contact here. And all these tools were used for farming corn because there would have been fields of maize around Cahokia to feed the thousands of people that were there, as well as grinding, you know, so they would have understood that they needed to grind and turn things into flour. One of the key things that I think often doesn't get discussed because there are so many types of, I mean, there's lots of varieties of corn that come in all different colors, but there's also different types of corn in which certain corns are best as popcorns and some corns are sweet corn where you can eat straight. But if you're looking at growing something like a flower corn or a flint corn, those kernels, after they've dried, they actually have to be nixtamalized, which is taken from the ancient word for basically putting in an alkaline solution and opening up the pericarp of the corn kernels to release the niacin. And these ancient Central Americans, ancient Mexicans, figured out how to do this pretty early on because if you eat that type of those types of corn without nixtamalizing it, you in fact deplete yourself of niacin and develop pellagra, which is a nutritional deficiency. And when the Spanish brought maize to Europe, particularly when it got to Italy, they didn't nixtamalize. And also in the Philippines originally, they didn't nixtamalize. And so they all populations developed pellagra as a result until they figured out what they needed to do. So it's, you know, in a way, like it's a kind of a dangerous thing. You have to really be so thoughtful and careful. And this kind of ancient ingenuity is the thing that I think I'm so fascinated with. The science was acknowledged at that time and they knew what they needed to do. We do have a couple of small kind of hand tools that would have been used in the 19th and 20th century as well, but the biggest footprint in the exhibition comes from the St. Louis Science Center.
Now, insofar as the culture goes, because it's kernels of culture, maize around the world, is there something in particular that you learned in the course of curating this that that you can now like not unsee if you're just sort of out maybe at the supermarket or when you're looking at products that are derived from maize? Is there an example?
I would say I knew corn was used or maize products or, you know, byproducts were used for a lot of things, but I did not know that literally every part of the maize plant is used from stalk to kernel. And some of them obviously are used as, you know, corn starches and fixatives, things that we ingest or make up, for example, but also like that it's there's a certain type of material that creates a chemical that can make fireworks burn brighter. I mean, these are the kinds of things I didn't realize that corn had that kind of reach. So it's absolutely everywhere.
Right, it is everywhere. Neshka Pfeffer is curator at Missouri Botanical Garden. Neshka, thank you for joining us today.
This episode was produced by Roche Hemmings.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on the Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.